From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What are the odds? Warren Buffett puts up $1 billion for a perfect March Madness bracket, and no one wins. Every day, millions play the lottery. Political pundits and statisticians debate the odds of Democrats or Republicans winning in November. And then there's the chances of really finding Malaysia Flight 370. This hour on Point, the science, the math, the emotion of odds and probability. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Did you shoot for Buffett's billion in the brackets? Have you followed the furor over Nate Silver's political odds-making this week on who will take the U.S. Senate this fall, on the odds of finding Flight 370? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Lots of people dreamed about having the bracket that would bring home that $1 billion that Warren Buffett was at the heart of putting up. There were plenty of underdogs who shot that down. Just one of those underdog triumphs last week, 14th-seeded Mercer Bears from Macon, Georgia, beat the 3rd-seeded Duke's Blue Devils, 78-71 senior guard Kevin Canavieri on the Mercer Bears said he knew they could do it. Many others did not.
Duke is a great team. We knew we were going to get a tough game, obviously, out of anybody in this tournament. But like we've said, we've kept it within, but we believe we could beat anybody. And so we're confident, like I said, and no, we're not surprised by any means.
Joining me now from Hanover, New Hampshire, is Charles Whelan, senior lecturer in public policy and economics at Dartmouth College and author of Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from Data. Charles Whelan, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
We saw all these issues of odds, some just good sport and some really tragic, and then the political in the news in this last week, and we wanted to talk with you about how humans assess odds, how we intuit them, and how they're actually working around and maybe against us. What about the Buffett bet? Here it was for Quicken Loans. You know, they did a deal with Buffett. He put up the cash. They paid a price for him, in effect, to insure them on this bet. What about the calculation that he and they made there?
Well, I thought it was brilliant marketing. It also speaks to why people love NCAA basketball, which is that anything can happen. But really, going into that, when it was announced, anybody could look at this and say, boy, the probability of getting each game right is so low. In the later brackets, they're really just coin flips, and so it approximates the probability of just throwing lots and lots of heads in a row. And what Buffett and Quicken Loans and most people who study probability know is it's really, really hard to flip lots of heads in a row. So I'm not at all surprised by the outcome. I was thrilled by the whole shining of a light on probability.
So Quicken Loans got great marketing out of this. They cut a deal with Warren Buffett that he would put up the billion. Of course, they had to pay him a kind of insurance fee, and he had to calculate how much to charge for that and what the odds might be. Earlier this month, Warren Buffett talked with CNBC about his $1 billion NCAA perfect bracket bet and the probabilities behind it.
If it were purely chance, so that each team was as likely to win as another team, then it would be something like 2 to the 63rd or that. But it's not that at all. It's not like flipping coins. The number one seed team has beaten the number 16 seed team over 100 times in a row. The number two seed has almost always beat the 15 seed. So you just have to make a calculation as to probabilities, and there's no right answer. I made a calculation. Another fellow at our insurance company made a calculation. We were sort of in the same ballpark, though it was a very large ballpark, and then we quoted a price.
All right, Charles Whelan, there's Warren Buffett with his back-of-the-envelope calculation. How would you calculate these odds? I mean, how do you even begin to do it? And to put a price up against, you know, what you'd charge Quicken Loans to be willing to put up $1 billion if somehow somebody magically did win?
He gave you a hint at how he did it. In the early brackets, you put a number against the probability that the number one seed beats the number 16. So maybe there's a 90%, not even 95% chance that you can get that right. And then as you move on to the later brackets, you're going to get good teams playing other good teams, and it's going to get harder and harder. So you may say, all right, well, there's about a 60% chance if you go with the higher seed in the second or third round, you're going to get it right. But as I noted earlier, by the time you get to the final rounds, it really is a complete toss-up. So I think you kind of aggregate the probabilities of getting those things right. Waiting the early rounds is easier, and mostly just a toss-up as you get to the later rounds. And then you run a bunch of numbers and say, what are the odds that somebody gets all of these right in a row? And it may not turn out to be 2 to the 63rd, but it turns out to be a very, very large number. Warren Buffett, by the way, is a guy who's not always right, but he just has to be right more often than he's wrong. That's how you make money in investing and insurance, and this is exactly how it worked out here.
I mean, on the one hand, you could say, I mean, I've seen the numbers run. If somebody picked 90% of all the results correctly in the brackets, which would just be unbelievable in itself, the odds of them, you know, clearly they're still way off. If you were sort of betting 50-50, I read that the odds of getting the bracket, if you had a 50-50 on each decision, the odds would be 9.2 quintillion to one. And yet, you know, as they always say with the lottery, it could happen. Somebody might win it. You might be the one.
I think that's what's most interesting here is when the contest was first announced, most of us, including myself, said, well, you know, I could do that, or if I couldn't do it, at least I could get a bunch of friends together and one of the 10 of us will do it. I mean, your instinct is this can't be that hard. And this is true of a lot of probability kinds of things where our initial response, the kind of emotional response, where we're hardwired throughout evolution to make quick decisions, is not always consistent with what the numbers later show. So we may be more afraid to fly, particularly this week because of the news about the airline disaster, when in fact driving to the airport is what we should be afraid of. We're worried about snakes. In fact, what we should be worried about is not, you know, putting sunscreen on when we go out in the sun.
Are we, as a species, despite all of our foibles and failings, are we pretty good at assessing probabilities and odds? Is that how we manage to have lifespans of more than a few days? Or are we lousy?
We're both. We're pretty good at making an instantaneous decision that, boy, something slithering might be a poisonous snake. I should jump away because the cost of not jumping away is pretty darn bad. So our initial response is pretty good from an evolutionary standpoint. But as we get into more complicated things like sun exposure and comparing different kinds of travel and drafting baseball teams, well, those are things that require more thought. And then your gut, I think, can lead you quite far astray.
Stand by, Charles Leland. It's great to have you with us. With us right now from Montclair, New Jersey, is Peter Keating, senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, runs ESPN's blog Giant Killers, which uses statistics to forecast the NCAA tournament. Peter Keating, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. So you guys are famous for assessing which dark horses may in fact upset low seeds, may upset very high seeds. With all of your computing power, why didn't you take home the $1 billion, Peter?
First of all, thank you for saying we're famous for anything. So that's a big step in the right direction
okay.
for us. Second of all, just the reason is just what you and Dr. Whelan were talking about. Given the odds that anybody could pick, let's say, 70% of the games correctly, this tournament challenge could have gone on for something like 520 years with 11 million people playing before you'd expect anybody to get all of these games right. And the reason is very simple. It's just because there's so many that you have to pick correctly. You know, if you have just a 10 or 30% chance of getting any individual game wrong, you're doing really well. But given the number of trials, the odds just keep growing exponentially. And so it's no surprise that nobody has a perfect bracket or that hardly anybody's even close. I think what's interesting is that the NCAA tournament is designed this way on purpose. It's designed to deliver upset after upset after upset. Just as a matter of probability, because the NCAA loves to market its tournament based on its unpredictability. You know, the NBA has its championships in the springtime.
Yeah.
You say you have basketball in the spring, but the NBA playoffs are a grind of seven-game playoff series because the NBA is invested in making sure the best team wins its championship. The NCAA, playing the same sport in the same time, much rather has a much different focus. It wants a couple of surprises here and there and wants chances for the heavy favorites to stumble, even though they are heavy favorites, because people love watching Duke, but they also love watching Duke lose, right?
Yep.
So this is a structural issue. There's nothing magical about college basketball or this time of year. The NCAA has set it up this way. So I just think it's interesting. We should keep that in mind. I mean, this is all, you know, there's a business design behind this tournament structure.
Well, odds fascinate us. And so whether it's for Warren Buffett and Quicken Loans or for the NCAA, or we're going to hear later in this hour from a business that bet on a baseball team and the World Series, they lost that bet, had to pay out pretty substantially, but still perhaps were winners in the end. Peter, if you were just smart enough, if you had a supercomputer big enough and you poured all your data in, do you think you would get closer to that billion-dollar prize?
I think you could get closer because I think that the statistical variables of team play that contribute to success in a tournament like this aren't perfectly understood out in the big world, and so there are market inefficiencies to exploit. And so, for example, the Vegas lines on these games, which are how you can bet the margin of victory, your predictions are not only who's going to win, but by how much, they may not perfectly incorporate everything we know about just why underdogs pull off big upsets. And so I do think you can get closer, but nobody's going to have a perfect bracket for a long time.
Peter Keating, please stand by there. Charles Whelan, we're talking about odds of winning, the science and emotions of probability. The Killers here with Shot at the Night, the 2014 March Madness theme. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Give me a shot at the night.
We got to seize the moment.
Give me a shot at the night.
It's going to come down to the last shot.
Give me a shot.
UCLA is back in the Sweet 16.
Virginia, the number one seed in the East.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Little NCAA montage of March Madness there, and we're talking this hour about odds. Odds of winning, finding, scoring, in brackets, in politics, in finding airplanes. In life, the science and emotions of probability. Charles Whelan has been with us from Dartmouth College, joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire today, author of Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from Data, and Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. He likes his odds and probabilities naked, I guess. And Peter Keating is here from Montclair, New Jersey, senior writer for ESPN, the magazine, runs the Giant Killers blog there. It's the metric-based forecast for the NCAA tournament and Giant Killers. There have been a lot of those. Stanford brought down Kansas. Mercer brought down Duke. North Dakota, Oklahoma, Harvard, Cincinnati. Those are the surprises of March Madness. Let's go to EJ in New Orleans. EJ, thank you for calling. What do you think, EJ? Did you win? Did you come close to the billion?
No, I didn't fall for the gimmick. I think it was all a setup.
A setup for what, EJ?
For Vegas and the big money, where the big money is being spent. Somebody paid a lot of money just to find out what most people think about odds and how they would bet, and then use that same information in that big computer that you spoke about and come out with a lot of different options and odds to win a lot of money in Vegas.
EJ, you got a jaundiced eye on all this, but I don't know, Peter Keating, if you've got secret sauce for Giant Killers, maybe Vegas has secret sauce tied into Warren Buffett to Quicken Loans supercomputers. What do you say, Peter?
Well, it would be interesting to see if you looked at all the people who participated, right, if you crowdsourced this question, how that bracket fared among all the entrants, right? And it's probably not going to be the best, but it'd be interesting to see if it was above average. It brings up an interesting point, which is you don't have to have a perfect bracket to win your office pool. You just have to be better than everyone else, right? So there's a second goal here that's luring people into participating in stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really the $1 billion. It's more the idea that you can talk about how close you came, you know, and how short you were of that $1 billion, but also about how you beat your coworkers, right?
Sure.
So There's that, too. And so it's interesting. I think it's probably a better way to judge the bracket as a game and also your performance is probably see how you did compared to everyone else. For example, President Obama was in the 92nd percentile of all ESPN bracket submissions.
Pretty darn good.
Pretty darn good, even though it's nowhere near perfect.
You know, Charles, that takes us to some of the psychology of this. I mean, maybe on odds, same with the lottery. What are the odds of winning? But there's a pleasure just in playing. Now here, for Buffett, it's a heck of a lot harder. I mean, by country, more than by galactic miles to get it perfect. Winning the office pool, not so hard. But we love sort of testing ourselves against the odds, Charles, even without a victory.
I think there's an important distinction. I agree completely that we get utility out of office pools, and some people get utility out of lotteries where my mother-in-law gives us tickets over Christmas and it's fun to scratch it off just because you think you might win.
Yeah.
The danger lies when you actually think you will win. And there are folks who think that going to Vegas or playing the lottery is actually an investment. And that becomes dangerous because at that point, you are profoundly at odds with what probability tells you is likely to happen. And that can be dangerous if it is guiding your retirement strategy or a lot of disposable income.
Let's go to Justin in Columbia, South Carolina. Justin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah.
I guess my question for the panel was more about, I guess, an idea of heuristics and that There's been a study in economics and in psychology, kind of a melding of the two, where they actually show that we as humans make huge errors in decision-making based on what we think about probability. I guess I'd leave that for the professor from Dartmouth to kind of, if he could explain that.
The heuristics, no less, of how we think about it. Charles, you want to bite on that?
Sure. Heuristics are just shorthand decision-making processes, kind of a classic back of the envelope. You see something, you make a snap decision. It's kind of what I was talking about in terms of something slithering in the grass. Your quick decision is it's a snake. The caller is absolutely correct, which is for a number of reasons that we're now beginning to understand better, those decision-making processes can be flawed. For example, one thing we tend to do is overweight recent experiences. So I alluded earlier to the fact that people are always afraid to fly, but they're particularly afraid to fly this week because there was a plane crash last week. And that shouldn't make any difference because if you look over the last 10 years, last 20 years, flying is unbelievably safe, safer than it's ever been and clearly safer than other modes of transportation. But that's not the way our brains work. We're wired to place a lot of emphasis on things that we see personally, things that we see recently, and that can lead us astray. So, for example, if the stock market was up last week or even last year, we tend to overweight the probability that it's going to be up this year, when in fact longer data suggests it's going to return to something closer to a normal return.
We're going to hear in just a moment from a man who bet the farmer at least a lot of furniture on the World Series in baseball. One more call first, if I may. Mike in Spokane, Washington. Mike, thanks for calling. You're on.
How you guys doing? Thanks. I love the show. Got a couple quick questions. My first one is, what was the final game that busted all the brackets, if anybody may know?
I think it was Mercer, Peter Keating. Is that right? Was Mercer what blew it out?
Well, you guys have had Mercer on, and for good reason. They do what you need to do to beat a big favorite, which is that they can really vary their scoring. They shot a lot of threes against Duke, and they hit a lot of them. It was a combination. It was Mercer and then also Dayton. Very few people had Dayton winning one game, let alone two.
Within 2 days, Warren Buffett's billion was safe. And your second observation, Mike?
My second, wasn't it pretty ingenious, Quicken Loans, to have everybody sign up on their website?
Well, you had to go and what? Put in some kind of information. So it was a big.
You had to go put in your information, and it's in, you know, the chances of winning. But they've got 200, or couple million emails now that they can now send out to people.
And I think you had to even put in more data than that, Peter Keating. Do you know what you had to punch in addition to your bracket for Quicken?
All I can say is that while you were picking Eastern Kentucky, you were able to get a refinance. Is what I'm my understanding.
All I can say is that we're talking about Quicken Loans right now on right. National radio.
Right.
So
right.
Clearly, somebody was thinking clearly.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right.
No.
There's your heuristic right there. Sign up yeah. for stuff while you're distracted.
Yeah, right. And they've got your data. Tony in Augusta, Georgia. Tony, you're on.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out that a lot of folks are doing this billion-dollar bracket and, you know, playing the quote-unquote odds when, in fact, only 15 million were allowed to even enter. I've read the rules, you know, and you also had to have a Yahoo account, which probably knocked out a few more.
So they weren't going to have a trillion entries, and so Warren Buffett putting a cap on that as well. And when you get into probabilities and actuarial and statistics, it pays to know how to frame the whole thing. Tony, I appreciate your call from Augusta. I want to bring in somebody right now who has been around this track. Elliot Tadelman is with us. He's owner of Jordan's Furniture Stores. In 2007, Jordan's in the Boston area, they ran a promotion. You said, buy any sofa or dining room table or bed or mattress, and if the Red Sox would win the World Series, the price of the furniture would be refunded. That seemed like maybe a long bet early in the season. In the event the Red Sox did win, Jordan's Furniture paid out. We're seeing Jordan's Furniture on the air. And Elliot Tadelman is with us. Elliot, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. So did it break your bank? How did all this work out for you, Elliot?
Oh, first of all, we bought insurance for it ahead of time. By coincidence, I sold the company back in 99 to Warren Buffett. So Warren Buffett does own the company. I don't. I'm president CEO.
Of course.
But we came out with the promotion when we were working with the Red Sox and became the official furniture sponsor of the Red Sox. And we came up with the idea, listen, if you're from Boston, you know how the Red Sox are loved here.
Sure.
And the difference between a lot of what you're talking about and what we did is that people did not pay to play. Our prices did not change. You came in, you bought a sofa, you bought a bed, and if the Red Sox won, it was yours free. Well, it turned out they won. 25,000 families got back close to $35 million in furniture. Well, that's how many checks went back to the public.
Wow, $35 million bucks.
Close to $35 million.
Now, what did it cost you to buy insurance to cover you against an unknowable number of purchases in that period?
Well, the whole idea was, obviously, like if you're in the retail business, you look at increasing your business, and if we run this promotion, will we increase the business to pay for the insurance and pay for the promotion, which we absolutely did. Because if you were in the market at that time to buy any of these products, any furniture, why would you go somewhere else when you had the chance to get it free, when you're dealing with a store that has a great reputation and has a great selection and good values and prices to begin with?
I mean, ABC News looked at you guys back in at the time when this ran. They talked to an odds company in Reno, Nevada. Their back of the envelope was that if you were going to have to end up giving away $15 million in furniture, you'd have to spend $4 or $5 million for the insurance. Can you give us a number, Elliot? What did you spend on that?
Unfortunately, I cannot give you that number, but I will tell you that it was an incredible promotion, and it worked very well for us. And I will guarantee you, if you know anybody in Boston, that if you call them and ask them, did you or do you know somebody who won free furniture? They all do, because everybody that won brags about it.
Yeah, of course. Hey, I've got to ask you this. Warren Buffett owned your company at that time when you did this big bet on the World Series. Was that his idea or yours? I mean, did you inspire him with this billion-dollar bracket idea in effect, or was he always into this?
It was the other way around. I called him with the idea, and I said, what do you think?
So maybe you're the father of the billion-dollar bracket challenge.
Well, if you want to call it that, no. I had nothing to do with the billion-dollar bracket. That was all Warren.
Peter Keating, what do you hear in this story?
Well, a couple of things. Warren Buffett is at the root of a lot of this stuff, huh? Number one.
Yeah.
Number two, the idea of saying, why would you go anywhere else when you could come here with a chance that it would be free, it is a great marketing concept, right?
Sure.
And the third, I think people don't really get out in the world how much reinsurance and just the insurance market and actuarial folks are underlie a lot of this. You know, nobody was really risking $1 billion in Warren Buffett's company. Warren Buffett's people were working out all the probabilities and then going to an insurer to back them up. And then finally, just to jump back to something Dr. Whelan said before, there is a big difference between something like this, which is a lot of fun and in a private market, and where all kinds of people can get a lot of happiness out of this, and kind of state-sponsored lotteries. You know, when taxpayer funding goes to governments that kind of advertise the idea that you have a chance to win this stuff and kind of warp your sense of the probabilities, that's a lot more insidious than playing in an office pool or having a chance to win free furniture.
The money goes out of your pocket, and there's nothing to sit on as a result in the living room. Elliot Tadelman, you're a good sport to be with us today. Are you glad you did it, even though the Red Sox won? Who's going to be unhappy about that, at least in your town, Boston? But did the whole thing work out for you?
It was the best promotion we ever ran, and the best part was is that I got to be on the float with David Ortiz and Manny in the parade when they won the World Series, and it was just a great promotion. We have done it ever since. I mean, ever since 2007, we have run hitting a sign in the center of Fenway Park, your furniture would be free.
Yeah.
Last year, it was the perfect game if a Red Sox pitcher got a perfect game. And we're working on something very exciting for this year as well, which I can't tell you about yet.
All ears. Elliot Tadelman, Chairman CEO of Jordan's Furniture Stores. Elliot, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Mike in Somerville, Massachusetts. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How goes? I really appreciate the program. And it seems to be fortuitous that I slipped in when I did. Having just spoken with your interviewer, I was just remarking on my situation. I'm down in a low area neighborhood. I live in supported housing. It is not housing projects per se, but I do live adjacent to housing projects. I'm in a Section 8.
Like low-income housing. Okay. What do you see there? What do you see there, Mike?
I see precisely the folks who are allegedly being helped out by said taxes from said lottery being precisely the wrong people, if I may be so bold. And I'm not certainly trying to throw out any moral judgment here. I have my own troubles with junk food. It seems.
But you're speaking to Peter Keating's point that you've got people without much money spending maybe more than they ought to on a lottery that's very unlikely to pay back for them.
You're targeting precisely the same people who you're trying to help who are, I can't point to any direct sources here, but I have a sneaking suspicion that as with drug abuse and alcohol abuse and tobacco abuse, it's precisely the same folks that you're meaning to help.
Yeah, exactly. To Peter's point, luckily the Buffett billion was free to play, I guess. You just maybe gave up a little personal information. Mike, I appreciate your call. We're going to look at a little bit at politics. We're going to look at the Malaysian airliner, the missing airliner. I don't know. Peter Keating, what do you think? Is this going to become a fixture now, the billion-dollar March Madness bracket idea? It was pretty exciting for people. Everybody chattered about it.
I think people loved it. I think it's going to spawn imitators. I think it's going to go on. And I do think by getting the people to talk about just how long the odds are, by bringing the mathematicians out of the woodwork on this, it's actually served an educational as well as a fun purpose. So, I think it's here to stay.
Well, it may end up giving us all an education, as you say, in statistics, in odds. We'll all become reinsurers on the fly. Peter Keating with ESPN the magazine, with the Giant Killers blog. Peter, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Anytime.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about odds. Odds of winning, finding, scoring, in brackets, in politics, in finding airplanes, in life, looking at the science and emotions of probability. Charles Whelan joins us from Dartmouth College, author of Naked Statistics, Stripping the Dread from Data. Joan in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Joan. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So on October 3rd, 2013,
yeah,
I bought a $2 lottery scratch-off ticket, a jumbo.
Okay.
And I scratched off $50,000.
Okay.
I know. Isn't that fabulous?
That's a pretty great feeling. Where were you standing when you did it, Joan? Where were you when you scratched it off?
You know, I was at home, and I actually had scratched off two before prior to that. And when I saw it was one number, I said, oh, well, it's probably just going to be a ticket. And so I saw the number come across, and I looked again, and I started hyperventilating, and I asked my friend to look, and she started hyperventilating, and it was too late to go to the lottery board, so I sat up all night just staring at the ticket, like willing it not to change into something, well, should I be wrong? And the next day I went to the lottery board, and they took $13,000 out of it.
Yeah.
But it was still a good $2 investment. But I will say that I've been playing for several years, so more than likely I put $50,000 into it. But it was still fantastic. And I do have one question.
Yes.
My son, my 20-year-old son, who is still my baby, lives in San Francisco. He's fellowship. He was awarded the Thiel Fellowship. Never mind that.
Great.
So now I want to know, can you statistically figure out when the next big earthquake is going to come in San Francisco so I can tell my son to move?
Okay. We got it. We got it. Lucky Mama Joan wants to know about the next big one in California. What about statistics when it comes to natural disasters and events, Charles?
I think as far as earthquakes are concerned, we've made progress, but there's still an element of uncertainty there that we can't fully resolve. There's still too many things that we don't understand or can't predict. And that's an important point to remember here, is all of this still involves uncertainty. So I can tell you that you probably shouldn't play the lottery, or that Duke is probably going to win, or that the Democrats or the Republicans might win the Senate. But until those events actually happen, we're still speculating, and there's always going to be an element of uncertainty. The probability just helps us navigate that uncertainty.
Let's go to that political issue, because exactly this, probability and uncertainty, became kind of a hot topic this week. Nate Silver, who of course started in sports and has moved into politics, he's with ABC and ESPN now, he put out his latest statistical prediction. This was about the U.S. Senate in the midterm elections this fall. And his prediction was, I think, a 60% chance that Republicans would take the Senate in the midterms. Here's a little sound of that. That got all kinds of blowback from Democrats who were unhappy with Nate Silver, just as Republicans were unhappy with him around the last presidential election. But here was Nate Silver talking with ABC News' John Carl.
This is the drum roll.
Mm-hmm.
Republicans need 6 seats. What's the projection? How many are they going to pick up?
I'd say exactly 6, but it's probably 6 plus or minus 5. That means it could be...
That means they could pick up 11 seats?
They could, yeah.
What you're basically saying is a 60% chance that Republicans win the Senate.
Something like that. So you can kind of imagine like a bell curve distribution, yeah. Sort of, where this is the most likely outcome. This is what Republicans would need to take over. This is 51, right, for them.
Yeah.
So you see... Probably 60% of this pie is colored in here.
60% of the pie. Nate Silver there, infamously for some, giving the odds to the Republicans to take the Senate this fall. Now, this gets interesting, Charles. As supercomputers get bigger and Nate Silver figures out his models, you know, he's got a lot of faith in the numbers. We saw Karl Rove not happy with Nate Silver's predictions on the presidential election night last time out, and it was Silver who got it right. This week, though, it was all kinds of Democrats came out saying, hey, Nate, you know, you can't know that. Back off. You're changing reality by putting odds out there. You know, that puts wind in Republican sails. But Nate says, look, I've got the numbers. When there are... what's the word? When there are intangibles in here, Charles, how far can you credibly go with predictions like this?
You can go a little ways, but I wouldn't get carried away. A couple of things to remember. One is we're in March. The election is in November. There are things that are going to happen that will change attitudes. The performance of the Obama administration, the nature of the economy, any unforeseen disasters, what have you. So no matter how good the model... We still have months and months of real developments that are going to shape people's opinions. Second, there is art attached to data here. So it's one thing to poll people or to look at other people's polls, and we can get a snapshot, a fairly accurate snapshot of how people are thinking today. But then you have to incorporate your judgment about how many of these people are actually going to vote. What's the weather going to be like? Are the young people who were inspired by Obama going to come out again? And that's the point where Nate Silver is injecting his informed opinion. And I think it's interesting to look at, but it is still informed opinion. And a number like 60% could be 58%, could be 65%. He'd be the first to tell you that. This is just an informed snapshot of what he thinks might happen in November. Anything beyond that is getting over-involved in what the data actually say.
Well, does that put you in the Paul Krugman camp then, the New York Times columnist, economist who came out and kind of said Nate Silver ought to pipe down because he's bending reality with his predictions and he can't know? You've got to have sector expertise beyond what he's applying here. You're a numbers guy. Where are your sympathies then, with Silver or Krugman?
my sympathies are with silver, which is this is an interesting thing to look at. I don't read too much into it. It doesn't affect my life. I don't actually think it's going to affect the election. It may mobilize one party or the other to raise a little bit of money. The emails came out fast and furious from both parties capitalizing on this. But I think Krugman is a little overwrought in terms of how significant this actually is.
Let's go to Brent in Akron, Ohio. Brent, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to hear your guests talk about how the Great Recession was essentially caused by bad statistical models when putting together all the collateralized mortgage obligations of various flavors. That's all.
Okay, collateralized mortgage obligations. And how about it, Charles? Do you buy that? Were they bad models, or were people just throwing the models out the window and selling subprime, you know, and the devil take the hindmost?
The models were terrible. And that turned out to be worse than no models at all. I'm completely sympathetic to the message of the caller. And the reason is we often confuse precision with accuracy. So if I give you a GPS device and it says turn right in 98 feet, that's a precise answer. Now, if the computer software is bad, you're going to drive into a brick wall. So it's precise but totally inaccurate. The models that were used on Wall Street prior to 2008 were falsely precise. Meaning particularly the value at risk models, which ostensibly enabled banks, JP Morgan being the leader in the development of these models, to aggregate the amount of risk that the firm faced 99 times out of 100 over some finite amount of time. So the value at risk over the next 24 hours may be $92 million. The problem, as the caller intimated, was that embedded in those models was an assumption not only that real estate prices wouldn't drop appreciably, but that they wouldn't drop at all in the case of some models. That's the equivalent of having a broken speedometer. It's worse than no speedometer at all because you're staring at it thinking you're going the proper speed limit when, in fact, if you had no speedometer, you'd at least look out the window and use common sense. I do think that the false precision of these models contributed significantly to the way that the real estate bubble spread throughout the financial sector.
A gut guess can be bad. A terrible model can be way off, maybe worse, Charles Wheatland says. Speaking of terrible and odds, the whole world has been just fixated on Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 since it went missing more than 2 weeks ago now, and a lot of speculation about whether and where it would be found. Here's a little sound from 2 weeks ago when it was 10,000 square miles that they were searching. CBS News' Nora O'Donnell reporting on the search area for that flight.
The United States and nine other countries are involved in the search for Flight 370. Dozens of ships and aircraft are crisscrossing more than 10,000 square miles.
Eventually, that potential area for the loss of the plane would go as high as 2.2 million square nautical miles. Try finding that needle in that great expanse of ocean. Malaysia saying today that they think they've got a bead on where it may be. Now, this is the Malaysian transport minister talking about the continuing search for the missing Malaysia airliner.
So this is still the most credible lead that we have. And if it is confirmed to be MH370, at least then we can move on to the next phase of deep sea search.
And we're talking about 1,000-plus miles somewhere, they're suggesting, off the coast of Australia. With us right now from San Diego, California, is Colleen Keller, senior analyst with Metron Incorporated Scientific Solutions. They helped find the wreckage of the Air France 447 flight using Bayes' theorem. She's a former consultant with the U.S. Navy, and this is about improving your chances of finding something, pulling out the Bayes' theorem. Colleen Keller, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, do you think they know where this airliner is now with any precision, or are we still throwing darts?
Well, looking at the search area that they're combing right now, I wouldn't say they're precise at all, but it's very encouraging that we are at least in the right body of water, because before we were looking overland and over water, and our chances of finding anything were very small. So the key thing here is that if we can localize it enough, we can get detectors for the underwater locator beacons on the black boxes into the water. We have a short timeline now, less than 2 weeks to go before the batteries on the beacons run out. And that's going to really lead us to the wreckage on the bottom of the ocean if we can detect one of these signals. So just the fact that we are in the right area, hopefully, and that we can get these beacons and beacon detectors in the water is very encouraging.
So how would the math in the Bayes theorem, math and more, potentially narrow the odds here, Colleen?
Well, it's actually kind of neat, and people are intimidated by statistics, but the way I try to explain it is what Bayes' theorem does is it allows you to consolidate all the information that you have, including conflicting theories or hypotheses about what happened with the aircraft, together with quantifying the uncertainty in those things into an overall picture. And what we generate in this business for search is a probability map, or people call it a heat map. It's a map of the area that you grid into sectors, and each grid contains a likelihood of containing the target that you're looking at, the impact point for the aircraft in this case. The hotter areas are the areas where everything points to being a likely area, and the colder areas are where there's very low probability of finding the target.
This worked for you with the Air France flight over the South Atlantic, and what creates an area of heat?
If you have data that suggests that the aircraft went down in that area, that layers more probability in that area. And if multiple hypotheses point to that specific cell or grid cell, then that increases the probability even more that the target's there. So in the case of the Malaysian airline, we have a satellite hit that puts it in an area. We're trying to pick up wreckage, and if we can reverse the drift of the wreckage back to that general location, that would add weight to that location as well.
Is Bayes' theorem being applied in this search, or have you been sidelined as everyone's been looking all over?
Well, thank you for asking. We would love to get involved. We really think that our approach could help the effort. But as far as I can tell, they are not using Bayes' theorem. They're just doing general search, probably keying on the wreckage that they think they are seeing from satellites.
Terry in Robbins, Tennessee. Terry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Yeah. The odds would be improved greatly if they were going to use passive sonobuoys that I read about in Popular Science back in the 60s that you drop in the water from an airplane or helicopter, and it listens, and it would be able to pick up the pinging from that, just like the odds would have been improved if when the plane started turning off its communications gear, they started paying attention more, just like the 9/11 planes, when the first one was announced as a hijacking. If they had started taking it serious then, instead of 45 minutes later, could have avoided some disasters there.
Might have. Change your sense of what else was going on in the sky. I guess that's part of Bayes' theorem, is you keep bringing in the new information, you keep applying it to some kind of model. Terry, thanks for your call. Colleen, they're throwing technology at this. I think even the U.S. Navy's coming out now with some of this underwater listening. Presumably, with your theorem, that would continually be fed into your assessment of where and what.
Absolutely, yes. And to answer Terry's question, the air-launched sonobuoys don't listen at the correct frequency, so they shouldn't be able to pick up the underwater beacons. But the equipment that the U.S. Navy is bringing into theater now, and I think it'll hit the water today or be sent out to the site, is something that's towed just above the surface at the bottom of the ocean so it can get close, and it has a 1 to 2 mile detection range, and it'll hear the correct frequency for those acoustic signals.
But I read that only moves at the speed of a human walking. That's a lot of square miles to get around with that. Charles Whelan, do you bring Bayes' theorem into your work, or does this, I've seen it described as subjectivity run amok. How do you look at it?
I think it's a really important tool. The key is that you're injecting common sense. Now, to the critics, you could be injecting the subjectivity that you just discussed. But let me give you an example. Suppose we're testing the population for a disease like AIDS, where it's relatively rare, and even a very good test has a high incidence of false positives. If you get a positive test result, you're going to be extremely concerned. Bayes' theorem would say, all right, well, let's inject some prior information about whether you're in an at-risk pool or not. So if you're just a young person with no known illnesses and no behaviors that put you at risk, I'm going to say it's probably a false positive, and the data would probably support that. But if you tell me that you're an IV drug user, then I'm going to view that finding totally differently. So what Bayes' theorem does is allow us to bring that kind of information to the statistical feedback that we get to give us a better interpretation of the overall result.
Colleen Keller in San Diego, I know you're not tasked to do this, but have you done a back of the envelope on the odds that we will ever actually find Malaysia Flight 370?
I'm afraid I haven't put a pen to paper for that. We are trying to do some analysis here to in case we get called up, but I'm not going to cite any odds. This is a tough one.
Lots of wishes and lots of prayers for that even now. Colleen Keller at Metron Incorporated in San Diego, California, and Bayes Theorem is her business. Colleen, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Charles Whelan at Dartmouth College, author of Naked Statistics. You're a good sport to be with us today. We really had fun with it. Thanks so much for joining us, Charles.
Great. Now you got to get Jordan's Furniture to do the same thing for the Cubs.
Okay. Cubs, Padres, you name it. I think they're Red Sox folks. We'll see. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.